Hello and welcome to today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Thursday, November the 16th, 2023. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik, and here's our first story. It's entitled New Artist Showcase. Ho-Chunk Center Galleries Showcase Native American Artists. It's written by Dolly A. Butts. When Sun Rose Ironshell was growing up in Denver, she accompanied her mother to college classes at Iliff School of Theology. While her mother learned, the 10-year-old sat quietly in a corner, coloring for hours. Today, Ironshell's dining room serves as her studio. It's where the contemporary artist and designer creates ledger art, narrative drawing or painting on antique paper from discarded record-keeping books. Ironshell, who is Sikagu and Oglala Lakota of the Titiwan Band of the Ossetti Sakawin, said there are a lot of layers to her artwork, which she makes with colored pencils, acrylic paint, watercolor markers, and gold leafing pen. Each of her pieces tells a story. I'm fighting against a mentality where people think we don't exist, Ironshell said of Native Americans. Ironshell, who moved to Sioux City during the pandemic, is one of five Native American artists whose work is being celebrated in a New Artist Showcase Friday at Gallery 103 and Three Rivers Art Gallery in the Ho-Chunk Center. The works of Ironshell, Henry Payer, Ed Encinas, Ernest Ricehill, and Savannah Anderson join those of Tanny Russell and other local Native American artists, whose photography and encaustic artwork has been displayed at Gallery 103 for a couple of years. Both galleries are seeking to increase the diversity of artists being spotlighted. It's inspired by the fact that there are five new artists in our shared galleries, and it's exciting because the five new artists are all Native American artists, Terry Parrish McGaffin, a Gallery 103 artist, said of the showcase. This is a way for us to acknowledge Native American Heritage Month, but also feature their artwork, which is unique. Ironshell said she draws inspiration from the works of the late Oscar Howe, who was a renowned Yanktonai Dakota painter and longtime University of South Dakota professor. A lot of his pieces were very breaking the mold in being contemporary with that cubist type of movement. With my pieces, I'm using the lines of the paper, the grid of the ledger paper, to create those different blocks or squares, Ironshell explained. In Born of a Star, Ironshell tells the origin story of her people with geometric shapes and dentalium shells, which were associated with wealth and used as a popular dress embellishment, as well as source of trade on the prairie. Our DNA has those star particles. We come from the stars. We're a star nation. We come from a cave. So after the moon smashed into the earth, we were microorganisms, and then eventually we come out, she said. But as human beings, we came out of a cave, and they say that's in Minneapolis. Ironshell said she was thinking about the issue of abortion while creating The Portal is Opening. Thami, the Lakota word for womb, is Thami. At first, it didn't start out as a womb. I had initially done these circles. These circles are really prominent in the design, Ironshell said as she stood by the framed ledger artwork, which hung on a wall inside the main entrance of Gallery 103. The womb, they call this a portal to another world. Plains Indian men traditionally painted winter counts, pictorial calendars, and histories on bison hides. Ironshell likened the images they painted to mnemonic device that triggers your memory to tell a story. However, in the late 1800s, the Plains Indians were forced to use ledger books as their canvases instead of the hides amid a mass slaughter of bison herds by white settlers. By the close of the 19th century, bison had been hunted almost to extinction. When these ledger papers were being made in the 1800s, there was a lot of illegalization of our people. We couldn't sing, we couldn't dance, we couldn't do our ceremonies, we couldn't even wear our clothes, Ironshell said. A big part of why we switched from the hides to the paper was also because of the extermination of the buffalo. The United States government sent out the ammunition and everything. One dead buffalo, they said, was like one dead Indian. If you kill a buffalo, you kill an Indian. So now we don't have any hides. We have to use canvas and the ledger paper. Most of the ledger paper Iron Shell uses in her artwork comes from old businesses. Finding it can be difficult and the books are often costly, but Iron Shell has had success locating it at antique shops and sometimes on eBay. The quality of the papers are just so much thicker. They actually have those cotton fibers and linen fibers. The color of the colored pencils are supposed to come out more vibrant, she said. Iron Shell has her eye on stacks of ledger books containing Sioux City Police Department logins. She said she could make really awesome designs by utilizing the stamps on the pages. The books also lead her to think about how law enforcement treated Native Americans back in the 1800s. The Sioux City Police Department was founded in 1857. It's really interesting to think, what was the time frame? What were Indians doing? And then, now, how do I thrive? Said Iron Shell, who said she wants to reclaim that era. I touched all those police ledger books because that was like counting coup. Ledger art is prisoner of war art, according to Iron Shell. She said reservations are considered prisoner war camps. Since Iron Shell is still linked with the reservation, she said she still is a prisoner of war, citing the ongoing erasure of Native Americans, monetary sanctions, persistent stereotypes, and underrepresentation in society. I do art as my escape from all those issues. At the end of the day, I can't solve all those issues. We can just talk about it. But you have something pretty on your wall that makes you feel good, she said. The next article from the front page of the journal is entitled, Vietnamese Voter, No Idea Who Signed Form. Kim Taylor voter fraud trial enters third day of testimony. This is written by Nick Hytrek. On election day in November of 2020, Andy Liu was heading to the polling site to vote for the first time, excited to get an I voted sticker and post a photo of it on social media. On his way, he received a phone call informing him he didn't need to worry about it. My now late grandfather told me they'd already voted for me, Liu testified Wednesday. Liu, who was 18 at the time, said he hadn't known an absentee ballot request and ballot had been filled out and signed in his name. Shown those documents in federal court, he said he didn't know whose handwriting was on the forms or on the signature line. That is not my signature, he said. If it was a family member, he said, he didn't believe he had given anyone his consent to vote for him. He also did not remember Kim Taylor visiting the Sioux City home he shared with his grandparents, parents, and his brother, and bringing voting documents during the 2020 election cycle and filling them out for his parents and grandparents, all of whom are Vietnamese immigrants who are not fluent in English. Andy and his brother, Anthony, both born in Sioux City, are fluent in English. Taylor, a Vietnam native who met her husband Jeremy when he was teaching there, is charged in U.S. District Court in Sioux City with 52 counts related to voter fraud. Prosecutors say she operated a scheme in which she fraudulently filled out voting forms, including ballots for other Vietnamese immigrants living in Woodbury County, in order to score votes for her husband, who ran unsuccessfully for the Republican nomination for U.S. House seat in June 2020 primary before he was elected to Woodbury County Board of Supervisors 5 months later in the general election. Jeremy Taylor has not been charged and is named as an unindicted co-conspirator. During the trial's third day Wednesday, Liu's father, Nguyen, who came to the United States in 1999, said he speaks, reads, and writes very little English, testified with the aid of an interpreter that Kim Taylor came to their home with voting documents, went over them, and had them sign them. She told all of us about the election and told us where to sign, Nguyen said through an interpreter. She filled them out, and I signed. Among the documents filled out were absentee ballot request forms and voter affidavits in Andy and Anthony Liu's names. Viewing an April 2020 voter registration form in his name, in which the political party affiliation had been changed to Republican, Anthony Liu said he's never changed parties and the handwriting and signature on the form were not his. Any idea who filled out this form? Assistant U.S. Attorney Richard Evans asked him. I do not, Anthony Luz said. Nguyen Hoan, a U.S. citizen born in Vietnam who immigrated here as a child with his family in the year 2007, said he's interested in voting but has never registered. Assistant U.S. Attorney Ron Timmons showed him copies of a 2018 voter registration form, as well as absentee ballot requests and voter affidavits from 2022, all filled out and signed in his name. Do you have any idea who filled out this form and signed it? Timmons asked him. No, no idea, Hoon said. Hoon's father, Nghi Hoon, who lives with his son and is not fluent in English, testified through an interpreter that he is not a registered voter, but Kim Taylor has come to their home 3 or 4 times with voting forms for others in his family. Late in the 2020 election, he said, Taylor came to his home to collect those forms. New Hoon said he gave her everything he had, but did not fill out or sign any documents because his son, who he said interprets all important papers for him, wasn't there. All this time, any paperwork at all, I don't sign anything unless my son told me, he said. Mai Do, a Vietnam native who came to the United States in the year 2000, said she filled out election documents, including ballots that Taylor brought to her home for herself and her two sons in the 2020 election. She signed her son's names on all the documents, she said, through an interpreter, because she believed it was her responsibility to vote for them. Taylor, she said, did not read her affidavits explaining the forms must be signed by the person whose name appears on the forms. She didn't explain. She just filled them out and I signed, Doe said. I did not know I was violating the law when I did that. If I knew, I wouldn't dare sign it. Taylor's mother, who has attended the trial since Monday's beginning, was warned by Chief U.S. Judge Leonard Strand Wednesday after Evans informed him she'd been seen talking with Andy and Anthony Liu and their mother during a break. According to Evans, Taylor's mother told them Kim Taylor was facing 200 years in prison if she was found guilty. Evans asked Strand to remove her from the courtroom. Strand declined, but said any future confirmed conversations with witnesses would have consequences, including a contempt of court charge. Ms. Taylor's mother cannot have any contact with witnesses, and if it happens again, she will be punished, Strand said. The trial will resume Thursday morning. School board denies land purchase. This is written by Caitlin Yamada. The Sioux City Community School District voted against purchasing land formerly known as the Southern Hills Country Club for a combined Sunnyside and Nodland Elementary School. The 43 acres of land is located at 2900 South St. Aubin, 2832 South Patterson Street, and 4243 Lincoln Way. It would have cost the district $457,000 and would have been used for a combined Sunnyside and Nodland facility. The board held a public hearing for the purchase on Monday. After the hearing, the board denied purchasing the land in a 1-5 vote, with President Dan Greenwell the lone vote in favor of purchasing the land. Multiple citizens spoke against the purchase of the property, expressing concerns about the cost of preparing the land for a school and the impact of a future combination of Sunnyside Knott Elementary Schools. Neighbors of the property said it has not been developed on for 20 years due to the layout of the land and the potential cost of preparing it. They asked if the district had done any research on the property and the cost. Some of the concerns they laid out included the soil makeup, flooding, grading cost, and entrance for traffic. Tim Paul, the district's operations and maintenance director, said district staff, in partnership with DGR Engineering, has been working to review the property over the last few weeks, as well as a traffic study conducted. He said that based on the layout of the land, it would be best to build a school similar to Perry Creek Elementary, which is one level with an entrance and exit on Lincoln Way. He said there is a flat area on the northern side of the property that could be viable for the school, with the rest of the land being used for fields, parking lots, and roadways. He added the project would involve a lot of grading work. Paul said there is not another parcel of land like the former golf course in Morningside for the same price. He said if the district were to decide to expand the Sunnyside lot by purchasing people's homes, it would be financially comparable or more expensive. Sunnyside Elementary is at 2700 South Maple Street, and Nodland Elementary is next door at 3300 South Cypress Street. Nodland is a pre-K through second grade, and Sunnyside is third through fifth grades. Early Wine said Sunnyside and Nodland are the only separate elementary schools in the district, and combining them would make the elementary schools consistent throughout the city. Sean Olorundami spoke against the combination of Sunnyside and Nodland, sharing research shows when schools combine elementary schools, there is a negative impact on behaviors, academics. Olorundami said combining neighboring elementary schools into larger schools is one of the worst decisions the district has made. He suggested the district spend the money on renovating the current Nodland and Sunnyside schools, as well as focusing on continuing to update the three 50-year-old high schools. Paul previously said the district has been looking for land in the Morningside area because the Sunnyside site would be too small for a new facility. The prospect of purchasing the land was brought forward at the previous school board meeting. Superintendent Rod Earlywine said when the opportunity was brought forward to him, he said it was a no-brainer to look at. While the land has not been developed since the golf course closed, Paul said the property just recently became available for purchase, and there have been multiple people interested in purchasing it. Earlywine added the opportunity will be gone if the district waits to purchase. Board members voiced their concerns with the site, stating they would rather wait and do research instead of rushing to purchase. Board member Bob Michelson said he would rather wait and lose the opportunity than not spend adequate time researching the land. Other board members echoed his concerns. Board member Bernie Scalaro said at first she thought it was a good deal, but after looking at the property and thinking about it more, she believes the district has not had an opportunity to do their due diligence. Previously, the school board member spoke positively about the prospect of purchasing new land in the Morningside area. However, after hearing from the community, many board members voiced concerns about the land and the seemingly fast process. Man sentenced for sexual contact with child. Dateline is Storm Lake, Iowa. A Lakeside, Iowa man was sentenced Monday to 10 years in prison for having sexual contact with a 9-year-old child in Storm Lake nearly 5 years ago. Harney Dosalau, age 36, had entered Alford pleas in May in Buena Vista County Court, 2 counts of lascivious acts with a child. In an Alford plea, a defendant does not admit guilt, but the judge enters a guilty plea into the record. Charges of second-degree sexual abuse and lascivious conduct with a minor were dismissed as part of a plea agreement. After he's released from prison, Dosala will be required to register with the Iowa Sex Offender Registry, and District Judge Nancy Wittenberg also ordered him to serve a lifetime special sex offender sentence after he completes his prison sentence. If he were to violate the terms of the special sentence, he would be sent back to prison. The Storm Lake Police Department received a report of a sexual assault on February 16, 2022. An investigation revealed that the child was assaulted in December of 2018 in a home in the 500 block of College Avenue. Dosala was arrested February 24, 2022. 15-year-old charged in Lamar's hit and run. Dateline is Lamar's, Iowa. A 15-year-old boy is facing a felony charge in connection with a hit-and-run pedestrian accident in Lamar's Sunday, which seriously injured a woman. The teen, who was not identified by police, was arrested at 10 a.m. Tuesday on a charge of leaving the scene of an accident, a Class D felony. Police Chief Kevin Vandevecht said in a statement that the accident was reported at 7:23 p.m. Sunday at the intersection of 6th Avenue and 4th Street Southwest. Brandy Mall, age 45, of Lamar's, was struck by a vehicle while she was walking westbound in the north crosswalk of the intersection. The vehicle, a newer model red four-door pickup, fled the scene, traveling southbound on 6th Avenue Southwest. Mal was taken by ambulance to Floyd Valley Healthcare in Lamar's and was later flown to Mercy One Siouxland Medical Center in Sioux City. Video from various businesses and private parties helped authorities identify the vehicle as a 2003 Chevy Silverado 2500 and track its movements, according to VandeVoogd. While on patrol, a Lamar's police officer located the suspect vehicle, which showed evidence of the collision, VandeVoogd said. The vehicle was seized and the 15-year-old boy was subsequently taken into custody, charged, and taken to juvenile detention. The incident remains under investigation. And man accused of striking woman in head with pistol. Dateline is Sioux City. A Sioux City man was arrested Tuesday for allegedly striking a woman in the head with a pistol and threatening her life. The Sioux City Police Department said in a statement that Robert Anthony Steiner II, age 31, was arrested on a charge of domestic abuse assault, third or subsequent offense, a Class D felony. At 7 a.m. Tuesday, officers were dispatched to the 1300 block of West 3rd Street for a report of a domestic assault. On the scene, officers found the 31-year-old victim, who had injuries to her head. The statement said she reported that Steiner struck her several times in the head with a pistol and threatened to kill her. The incident occurred while the 2-year-old was sleeping in another room, according to the statement. After the assault, the statement said Steiner left the scene on foot. Officers found him inside of a residence in the 200 block of Rebecca Street. Macy man pleads guilty to shooting man in pinky. The dateline is Omaha. A Macy, Nebraska man pleaded guilty Tuesday of shooting another man in the pinky. Dante Stabler, age 22, entered his plea in U.S. District Court in Omaha to one count of assault with a dangerous weapon with intent to do bodily harm. According to terms of a plea agreement, he will be sentenced to 6 years in prison. Sentencing was scheduled for February 9th. A charge of using, carrying, or possessing a firearm during a violent crime will be dismissed at sentencing. The victim confronted Stabler on February 22nd in Macy about his stolen vehicle. Stabler is accused of firing a shot from a pistol into the pavement. The victim then charged Stabler and grabbed the pistol. When the victim grabbed the gun, Stabler fired a second shot, striking the victim's finger. While the victim was at the hospital in Winnebago, a nurse notified the FBI of the shooting, and the FBI began an investigation. Sioux City schools consider early out swap. Currently, all Sioux City community schools dismiss 1 hour early on Mondays. A proposed calendar will change that to a 2 hour early out on Fridays. Human Resources Director Jen Gomez presented proposed calendars for the 2024 through 2025, 2025 through 2026, and 2026 through 2027 school years on Monday. The biggest proposed change is moving the weekly teacher professional development. Instead of a 1 hour early out on Mondays, the district is proposing 2 hour early outs on Fridays. Gomez said the change is based on feedback received from district staff, parents, and committees. Superintendent Rod Earlywine said he has heard from other school districts in the state who have been making the same switch. I've heard really good things from those school districts that the parents are fine with it and the staff really likes it, he said. He said of the more than 4,000 responses to a survey, 63% of the responses said they were in favor of Friday early outs. A public hearing will take place on November the 27th for citizens to provide feedback on the proposed calendars. Another change to the calendar is the timing of school conferences. For years, the district has had parent-teacher conferences on Mondays and Tuesdays with no school on Mondays twice a year. The proposed calendar would switch the conferences to Tuesdays and Thursdays with no school on Thursdays. The district is continuing to base the school calendars on hours instead of days. In Iowa, a school year must consist of either 180 days or 1,080 hours of instruction. Historically, the Sioux City Community School District follows the number of days, often resulting in more than 1,100 hours of instruction. This school year, the district changed the calendar to be based on hours. The original 2023-2024 calendar has 180 days of education, resulting in 1,132 hours of instruction. The current calendar has 178 days and 1,136 hours of instruction. Gomez said the district received positive feedback about the change and plans to continue the format. The proposed calendar for next year has 178 days and 1,094 hours of instruction. Now we'll turn to the opinion page, and our first opinion is written by Cynthia M. Allen, who writes for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, and she can be reached at cmallen@star-telegram.com. And her opinion piece is entitled, "Homeschooling Has Gone Mainstream Across the U.S." I do not recall my exact reaction when my husband suggested that we consider homeschooling our children. Laughter seems plausible, particularly since we had no children yet when he casually worked its mention into our conversation. But my sense of homeschooling at that time was mostly that it was for families on the cultural fringe, that is, not us. Yet, here I am years later, not only a homeschooler, but a finding that our decision to educate our children ourselves isn't fringy at all. It's actually increasingly mainstream, if not slightly cool. According to a new analysis from the Washington Post, homeschooling is the fastest growing form of education in the U.S., not just in conservative states such as Texas, where I live. And it's not exclusive to conservative enclaves either. In New York City and Washington, famously bastions of progressivism, homeschool communities are growing and flourishing. Indeed, homeschooling is now a less ideological practice with more diverse practitioners, attracting families across the political spectrum and across various racial and ethnic communities. That's probably because today's homeschool families are motivated by an assortment of factors, not just moral and religious education, but also physical and emotional safety, social environment, curriculum, family flexibility, and accommodating kids' special needs and education goals. For most families, like mine, it's really a combination of reasons. And alongside traditional homeschooling models, we have seen micro-schools, hybrids, and co-ops providing families with a parent-led learning environment that provides social outlets as well as needed structure and support. Indeed, homeschooling's newfound social status should be seen as a challenge to the long-held notion that a quality education can only occur inside a traditional school environment. It's not exactly news that homeschooling ballooned during the pandemic. Those were the days when COVID-19 protocols, too strict for some and too lenient for others, and virtual learning provided a proverbial window into what was being taught in public schools and what wasn't. But the Washington Post data shows that while the number of children being homeschooled has declined slightly since its pandemic peak, the growth of homeschooling remains stable and significant. Before the pandemic, estimates suggested that about 1.5 million children in the United States were homeschooled. The latest data suggests that number is now somewhere between 1.9 million and 2.7 million, though because of the dearth of reporting requirements in many states, it's likely that number is even higher. In Texas, for example, which does not require homeschoolers to report to the state, the Texas Homeschool Coalition estimates that about 750,000 students are homeschooled. I'd wager that number may be even greater, especially given the Post found a dramatic increase in homeschooling among Hispanic families. Whatever the case, this is not a blip, but a fundamental shift in how our culture views education. Unsurprisingly, not everyone is pleased. Homeschool critics argue that the loose or non-existent regulation will inevitably result in substandard or parochial education. But one only need to look at standardized testing results in a district such as Fort Worth's, where minority students in particular consistently cannot read or perform math at grade level, to recognize that attending school in no way guarantees that a student receives a quality education. Then there are the detractors who deride homeschoolers for the same reasons they criticize private school participation, that it takes resources away from public schools. Public schools do indeed serve an important role in our communities, but they have never been a panacea. And with more families finding that public schools do not meet the needs of their individual students and circumstances, It behooves state governments to support alternative forms of education, such as homeschooling. The Texas legislature has had trouble reaching a deal on school choice legislation. That's unfortunate. Parents deserve choices in their children's education, and to give them the most possible, any bill should include support for homeschoolers. And again, this was written by Cynthia M. Allen, who writes for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. You are listening to the Sioux City Journal on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, please give us a call at area code 515-243-6833. Now we'll move to today's obituaries. First, Helen Hagen, age 89, of Kingsley, passed away Saturday, November the 11th at Kingsley Specialty Care. Funeral services will be held 10:30 a.m. Saturday, November 18th at Immaculate Conception Catholic Church, Mobile, Iowa. Burial will be at St. Michael's Catholic Cemetery, Kingsley. Visitation will be 5 to 7 p.m. Friday with scripture service at 7 p.m. at Road Funeral Home in Kingsley. Memorials may be directed to Kingsley Public Library in Helen's name. Next, Linda M. Smith, age 75, of Sioux City, passed away on Sunday, November the 12th at a local hospital. Memorial service 1 p.m. Friday, November the 17th at Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Burial, Graceland Park Cemetery. Lorraine Laura Vollers, age 91, of Sioux City, formerly of Pender, Nebraska, died of cancer on Saturday, November the 11th at Sunrise Retirement Community in Sioux City. Private family graveside services will be held at Rose Hill Cemetery in Pender. Arrangements are with Munderloh Smith Funeral Home in Pender, Nebraska, and they can be reached at Munderloh, Munderloh, funeralhome.com. Betty Louise Maxfield, age 97, of Sioux City, passed away November the 13th in Sioux City. A graveside service will be at 11 a.m. November the 16th at Memorial Park Cemetery. Christy Smith Funeral Home's Morningside Chapel is in charge of the arrangements. Online condolences can be left for the family at www.christysmith.com. Memorials may be directed to St. Luke's Unity Point Children's Miracle Network in Sioux City or the Food Bank of Siouxland, Incorporated. Larry L. Book, age 87, of Sioux City, Iowa, passed away on Tuesday, November the 14th. Funeral will be held 10 a.m. Tuesday, November 21st at Redeemer Lutheran Church. Visitation will be held 5 to 7 p.m. Monday, November 20th at Redeemer Lutheran Church with a prayer service at 7 p.m. Burial will be at Memorial Park Cemetery. William R. Bill Kelly, age 76, of Sioux City, passed away Sunday, November the 12th at a local hospital. Services will be held at 7 p.m. Tuesday, November 21st at Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel. Visitation with the family will be from 5 to 7 p.m. at the funeral home. Burial will be at Memorial Park Cemetery, 1 p.m. Wednesday, November the 22nd. Online condolences may be given at www.meyerbroschapel.com. In lieu of flowers, please donate to the Humane Society of Sioux City or Noah's Hope Animal Rescue in Bill's memory. Terrence Michael Mike McGregor, age 75, of Fremont, Nebraska, passed away Saturday, November 11th in Omaha. Funeral Mass will be 10:30 a.m. Friday, November the 17th at Blessed Sacrament Catholic Church in Lincoln, Nebraska. Father Timothy Cole Kennett will officiate. Visitation will be from 5 to 8 p.m. Thursday at Moser Memorial Chapel in Fremont, with a rosary starting at 7 p.m. Burial with honors will take place at 11 a.m. Monday, November the 20th at the Omaha National Cemetery in Omaha. Memorials may be directed to St. Mary's Catholic Church in Cedar Bluffs, Nebraska, American Cancer Society Hope Lodge, Nebraska, and Blessed Sacrament Catholic Church in Lincoln, Nebraska. Online condolences may be left at www.mosermemorialchapels.com. and Moser Memorial Chapel is located at 2170 North Summers Avenue, Fremont, Nebraska. And Susan C. Bremer, or Bremer, age 81, of Sioux City, passed away on Tuesday, November the 14th, at Sunrise Retirement Community in Sioux City. Mass of Christian burial will be at 10:30 a.m. on Saturday, November the 18th, at Meter Day Parish Immaculate Conception Catholic Church in Sioux City. Reverend Mark Stoll will celebrate Mass. Burial will follow the lunch at the church at Arlington Township Cemetery in Mobile, Iowa. Visitation with family present will begin after the parish rosary at 4:30 p.m. on Friday, November the 17th at Immaculate Conception Catholic Church. There will be a scripture prayer service at 7 p.m. Visitation will resume from 9:30 a.m. until service time on Saturday at the church. Arrangements are with Rex Winkle Funeral Home in Lamars. Expressions of sympathy can be extended to the family through www.rexwinklefh.com. Brings us to an article entitled The Long Road Ahead. What should you expect as you age? Doctor's book offers some answers. It's written by Judith Graham. How many of us have wanted a reliable, evidence-based guide to aging that explains how our bodies and minds change as we grow older and how to adapt to those differences? Creating a work of this kind is challenging. For one thing, aging gradually alters people over decades, a long period shaped by individuals' economic and social circumstances, their behaviors, their neighborhoods, and other factors. Also, while people experience common physiological issues in later life, they don't follow a well-charted, developmentally predetermined path. Predictable changes occur, but not necessarily at the same time or in the same sequence, said Dr. Roseanne Leipzig, Vice Chair for Education at the Brookdale Department of Geriatrics and Palliative Medicine at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York. No more heterogeneous a group than older people. Leipzig's book, Honest Aging, An Insider's Guide to the Second Half of Life, offers a comprehensive examination of what to expect later in life. Leipzig, aged 72, said she had two goals in writing this guide: to overcome all the negatives that are out there about growing older, and to help people understand that there are a lot of things you can do to adapt to your new normal as you age and have an enjoyable, engaged, meaningful life. Because of medical advances, people over age 60 live far longer than people at the dawn of the 20th century. Still, most of us lack a good understanding of what happens to our bodies during this extended period of middle age. Here are a few of the age-related issues Leipzig highlights in her book. Older adults often present with different symptoms when they become ill. For instance, a senior having a heart attack might be short of breath or confused rather than report chest pain. Similarly, an older person with pneumonia might fall or have little appetite instead of having a fever and cough. Older adults react differently to medications. Because of changes in body composition and liver, kidney, and gut function, older adults are more sensitive to medications than younger people and often need lower doses. Older adults have reduced energy reserves. With advancing age, hearts become less efficient, lungs transfer less oxygen to the blood, more protein is needed for muscle synthesis, and muscle mass and strength decrease. The result? Older people generate less energy even as they need more energy to perform everyday tasks. Hunger and thirst decline. People's senses of taste and smell diminish, lessening food's appeal. Loss of appetite becomes more common, and seniors tend to feel full after eating less food. Cognition slows. Older adults process information more slowly and work harder to learn new information. Multitasking becomes more difficult, and reaction times grow slower. Problems finding words, especially nouns, are typical. The musculoskeletal system is less flexible. Spines shorten as the discs that separate the vertebrae become harder and more compressed. Older adults typically lose 1 to 3 inches in height as this happens. Balance is compromised because of changes in the inner ear, the brain, and the vestibular system. Muscles weaken in the legs, hip, and buttocks, and range of motion in joints contracts. Tendons and ligaments aren't as strong, and falls and fractures are more frequent as bones become more brittle. Eyesight and hearing change. Older adults need much more light to read than young people. Color and contrast perception diminishes. With changes to the cornea, lens, and fluid within the eye, it takes longer to adjust to sunlight as well as darkness. Because of accumulated damage to hair cells in the inner ear, it's harder to hear, especially at high frequencies. It's also harder to understand speech that's rapid or that occurs in noisy environment. Sleep becomes fragmented. It takes longer for older adults to fall asleep, and they sleep more lightly, awakening more in the night. This is by no means a complete list of physiological changes that occur as we grow older, and it leaves out the many ways people can adapt to their new normal, something Leipzig spends a great deal of time discussing. A partial list of what she suggests: don't ignore sudden changes in functioning, seek medical attention. At every doctor's visit, ask why you're taking medications, whether doses are appropriate, and whether medications can be stopped. Be physically active. Eat enough protein. Drink liquids even when you aren't thirsty. Cut down on multitasking and work at your own pace. Do balance and resistance exercises. Have your eyes checked every year. Get hearing aids. Never say never, Leipzig said. There's almost always something that can be done to improve your situation as you grow older, if you're willing to do it. Now it's time for sports, and our first article is entitled Heelan's Finale, Crusaders Looking for One More Upset. It's written by Ryan Timmerman. Bishop Heelan is one of two teams standing in the Class 3A field after 9 weeks of regular season play and 3 weeks of playoffs. Here's how the two teams in the title game stack up. Number 8 Heelan with a record of 11-1 versus number 2 Williamsburg with a record of 11-1. The game will take place Friday, November the 17th at 1 p.m. at the Unidome in Cedar Falls. Heelan took down top-ranked Creston 16-13, and Williamsburg cruised to a 45-14 victory over number 3 Solon in order to get to the championship game on Friday. Heelan has enjoyed a return to prominence under second-year head coach John LaFleur after tallying just 5 wins over the last 4 seasons. It's the 38th playoff appearance for the Crusaders, who are aiming to obtain the program's 5th state title. Dual-threat quarterback Quinn Olson has spearheaded the effort, along with workhorse running back Ricky Fiato. Kaysen Thomas has also emerged as a weapon for the Crusaders and contributed in a number of ways on both sides of the ball, even taking snaps in Heelan's semifinal win when Olson went to the sideline for a brief period of time. In the passing game, Olson's top targets are Sir Brandon Watts, an athletic playmaker who can line up at running back or wide receiver, and University of Sioux Falls commit Cannon Bork, a standout at tight end and along the defensive line. Wide receiver George Ciabanos has also been crucial to Heelan's run as he caught a key touchdown late in the Crusaders' 3 overtime semifinal win over Sioux Center. Ciabanos also serves as kicker and made the game-tying point after his critical touchdown catch. Heelan also features a gritty, stout defense led by linebacker Max Delaney. Williamsburg avenged its one loss of the season by beating the Spartans, who beat the Raiders 21-14 in Solon in early October. Like the Crusaders, the Raiders squeaked by in the quarterfinal round as Williamsburg toppled 4th-ranked Mount Vernon 38-35. Last season, Williamsburg was the runner-up in Class 2A, losing to Central Lion George Little Rock in the championship. The Raiders have continued their success after being bumped up to 3A this season and are led offensively by dual-threat quarterback Derek Weisskopf, who completed 12 of 19 passes for 366 yards and 4 scores in the semifinal win over Solon. Kellen Cockrell has also seen considerable time behind center throughout the season and is a key contributor on the defensive side of the ball as well. Niall Sinn leads the running game, which has a season total of 1,725 yards combined on 347 rushes. Clayton Steckley, Braylon Wetgen, and Race Heitman are the main weapons in the passing game, and Heitman leads the defense with over 100 tackles on the season. Williamsburg maintains a 236-92 record on head coach Kirk Ritchie. It's the Raiders' 24th playoff appearance, but the program has never won a state title. In other high school football news, Lions looking for repeat title in 2A. This is also written by Ryan Timmerman. Central Lion George Little Rock is one of two teams standing in the Class 2A field after 8 weeks of regular season play and 4 weeks of playoffs. Here's how the two teams match up in the title game. Number one, Central Lion George Little Rock, with a record of 12-0, versus number two, Van Meter, with a record of 12-0. The championship game will take place Friday, November the 17th at 10 a.m. at the Unidome in Cedar Falls. Last week, CLGLR scored 21 unanswered points to power past number 5 Spirit Lake 28-14 in the semifinal round, while Van Meter defeated number 4 Monticello 35-21. CLGLR is the reigning 2A champions and returned to defend its title. The Lions have been down in each of their last two games, but have used comebacks in each to beat the Indians last Saturday and before that Kemper Catholic. CLGLR is led by a pair of Iowa commits in Reese Vanderzee and Graham Eben, and is anchored in the trenches by senior standout defensive lineman Gabe Schulte. The Lions boast a formidable secondary with Vanderzee and Eben at safeties and Matt Elbert and Reed Fulkins at cornerback. Vanderzee projects as a wide receiver at the next level, but has produced lots of yardage at quarterback with Eben beside him at running back. In the semifinals, Vanderzee went for over 260 total offensive yards and 3 touchdowns. CLGLR head coach Curtis Eben is in his 7th season and has a 56-20 record in that time. Van Meter started the season by topping 1A top 2 ranked Univer Underwood by a touchdown, 21-14, and went on to win every regular season game by at least 38 or more points. With the exception of the Underwood win, the Bulldogs scored at least 47 points in each game until the state quarterfinals, where it defeated PCM 35-21 before topping Monticello. Austin Baumover leads the offense at quarterback with a pair of highly capable targets in Cale Trudeau and Caleb Moore. The ground game has rushed for over 3,000 total, led by Ben Gordon. Porter Doggett, Toddy Seek, and John Braun lead a formidable Van Meter defense that has 7 fumble recoveries and 11 interceptions, 3 of which have been returned for touchdowns. The Bulldogs are coached by Eric Trudeau, who's in his 19th season with a career record of 172-43. In Class A South Dakota State Volleyball Tournament, Panthers aim for another run at state. The Dakota Valley High School Volleyball qualified for the South Dakota Class A State Tournament, which gets underway on Thursday. The Panthers entered as the number 7 seed with a season record of 19-10 and will play second-seeded Rapid City Christian with a record of 33-5 in the first round, as the Lady Comets will get some benefit of home court advantage at the Summit Arena at the Monument in Rapid City. The game is slated to start at 12:45 p.m. on Thursday, with the winner advancing to the play the winner of third-seeded Miller and sixth-seeded Wagner in the second round. DV is led by senior Sophie Tuttle, who surpassed 1,000 career kills and 1,000 career digs after the Panthers clinched a state berth by beating Aberdeen Ron Colley in straight sets in the South Dakota 16 round. The Panthers also boast a deep lineup that is young and talented. That group features sophomore standouts Claire Munch, Bria Perryman, and Samantha Kimball, along with juniors Reagan Grandstrom, Emerson Mead, Cameron Summerbold, and J.C. Squire, among others. Dakota Valley's closest playoff game came in the Region 4 second round, as the Panthers needed 5 sets to get past Elk Point Jefferson. That came after DV cruised in its postseason opener, defeating Vermilion in 3 sets, a match in which the Tanagers were held to 18, 13, and 21 points in the 3 sets played. Last season, the Panthers won the consolation side of the Class A bracket and finished with a record of 28-9. In Class A football, Woodbury Central primed for title game. Woodbury Central is one of two teams standing in the Class A field after 8 weeks of regular season play and 4 weeks of playoffs. They will take on West Hancock Thursday at 1 p.m. at the Unidome in Cedar Falls for the state championship of Class A. Last week, Woodbury Central slid by fourth-seeded East Buchanan in the semifinals 28-20, while West Hancock dominated the number 2 seed Madrid 39-14 to reach the title game. One of these two teams ranked atop most statistical categories in Class A, especially on the offensive side of the ball. Southwest Minnesota State commit Drew Klutner leads Woodbury Central as the quarterback is among the most productive signal callers this season, as he leads Class A in touchdowns as well as passing touchdowns, passing yards, and total offensive yards. Eric McGill and Sam Monk are his favorite targets in the passing game. McGill is a Class A leader in receiving yards and receiving touchdowns. Zach Butler is the go-to running back for the Wildcats, and the defense is anchored by McGill, Colby, Gilbert, and Butler, among others. West Hancock's 80 total touchdowns is 11 better than anyone else in Class A, as its title game opponent has the second most at 69. The Eagles' offense, though, is a stark contrast to Woodbury Central, as West Hancock has just 49 pass attempts on the season compared to Woodbury Central's 254. On the other hand, West Hancock outpaces the Wildcats on rush attempts, 438-353. Cale Zuhl leads that ground attack, with Mitchell Smith, Kellen Smith, and Jackson Peterson also see plenty of opportunities. Jamestown to rejoin NSAA. Jimmy's looking to move to NCAA Division II was removed from GPAC. The University of Jamestown, ousted by the Great Plains Athletic Conference last month, has found a new home for the 2024-2025 sports season. The North Star Athletic Association announced Tuesday that the Jimmies will temporarily rejoin the league that it left 6 years ago to become a GPAC member. Jamestown said it will play in the NSAA until its application for membership in the NCAA Division II Northern Sun Interscholastic Conference is approved. The Jimmies competed in the NSAA from its inception in 2013 to 2018, the year it left for the GPAC. The GPAC Council of Presidents voted last month to remove Jamestown from the conference. The University of Jamestown has been a good member of the GPAC since they joined the league, Northwestern College President Greg Christie, the chair of the GPAC Council of Presidents, said in a news release issued on October the 12th. We wish them all the best as they continue to pursue an opportunity to join the NSIC and a move to NCAA Division II. Jamestown is the only North Dakota member of the 12-team GPAC, which has members in Iowa, Nebraska, and South Dakota. Northwestern, Morningside, Briarcliff, and Dort are all members. Waldorf, a Forest City, Iowa-based private college, will join the league next season. Almost forgot to do the rundown on what's on TV today. In college basketball at 11:30 a.m. on ESPNU, it's the Myrtle Beach Invitational, College of Charleston versus Vermont quarterfinal. At 1:30 p.m. on ESPNU, it's also the Charleston Classic, St. John's versus North Texas in the quarterfinals. At 2 p.m. on ESPN2 at Myrtle Beach Invitational, St. Louis versus Wyoming in the quarterfinals. At 4 p.m. on ESPN2, it's the Charleston Classic, Dayton versus LSU, which is a quarterfinal matchup. At 4:30 p.m. on ESPNU, the Myrtle Beach Invitational features Wichita State versus Coastal Carolina in a quarterfinal matchup. 6:30 p.m. on ESPN2, it's the Charleston Classic, Houston versus Towson, quarterfinal matchup. And also at 6:30 p.m. on ESPNU, Legends Classic, Oklahoma State versus St. Bonaventure in the semifinals. At 7 p.m. on the ACC Network, it's Texas Southern at Virginia. And on the Big Ten Network, it's Wright State at Indiana. at 9 p.m. on the Big Ten Network. It's Missouri at Minnesota. On ESPN2, it's the Legends Classic, Auburn versus Notre Dame, which is a semifinal game. ESPNU at 9 p.m. and the Charleston Classic, it's Utah versus Wake Forest in a quarterfinal game. And on the Pac-12 network, it's Mass Lowell at Arizona State. Then at 11 p.m. on the Pac-12 network, it's Montana State at California. In women's college basketball, at 6:30 p.m. on FS1, it's Maryland at UConn. At 7 p.m. on the SEC network, it's Clemson at South Carolina. And at 8:30 p.m. on FS1, it's Kansas State at Iowa. College football at 7 p.m. on ESPN, it's Boston College at Pittsburgh. A couple of NBA games are on tonight at 7:30 p.m. on NBA TV, it's Brooklyn at Miami. And at 10 p.m. on NBA TV, it's Oklahoma City at Golden State. And of course, tonight's Thursday Night Football at 8:15 p.m. on Prime Video, and that's the Cincinnati Bengals at the Baltimore Ravens. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Sioux City Journal. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik, saying thanks for sharing your time with Iris, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the world.